our usual Institute people here, as well as a very welcome sprinkling of economists. And in asking people to join the Vancouver Institute, I will appeal particularly to those additional economists who are here today, and that means appealing directly to their self-interest. The Vancouver Institute has been for many decades now a place where the public gets informed about public policy and about economics. And I think it is very much in the interests of the economics department and the economists to have such a public forum. And therefore, I will want a lineup of economists at the desk after we leave tonight joining the Institute. The lectures are free. The information is free. But it is in your interest to join. We have a special treat tonight. We have a Woodward lecture from time to time. The Woodward lectureship brings us speakers here. I think they're usually in economics. I think it is an economics arrangement. And tonight we have Professor Richard Blundell from England. He has been a specialist in microeconometrics. I'm old enough to have lived in a time when there was almost no mathematics in economics. Then they discovered mathematics, I think, in mid-century, and econometrics eventually evolved, and now even microeconometrics. And so microeconomics is really a very multifaceted discipline. That doesn't mean that people don't speak on broad policy issues. We have a speaker tonight who has won prizes. He's won the Janssen Prize for his work in econometrics. He's a professor in London, and he's here as a Woodward lecturer at UBC. And we're very pleased today to welcome Professor Richard Blundell, who will speak to us about reforming our tax and welfare system. Professor Blundell, please give him a welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, of course. Thanks for the invitation. It's wonderful to be back in Vancouver after 15 years since I spent a year here as visiting professor. And it was soon after I came back from UBC that I was hoodwinked into running a research institute in London. And it's that work that we do at the Institute for Fiscal Studies that I'm going to focus my talk on here tonight. Perhaps I should warn you that it's 4:15 in the morning in London, and I only came 2 days ago, so excuse. Now, what I'm going to try and attempt is something better than that. Well, something better than that. That. And to do this, we have to dim the lights.
Now, can the people at the back see the screen? Because there's lots of room, and there's going to be a lot of projections on the screen. And if you cannot see, I would urge that you move forward now. Or from the sides as well. You'll see better if you want to move from the sides toward the center. This is an opportunity for moving without disturbing.
Okay, it must be clear or we're inaudible at the front. So what I want to discuss is work on reforming the tax and benefit system. We do a lot of work at the Institute on this area, and what I want to do is look at some characteristics of recent reforms. Of course, there's lots of reforms to the basic direct tax rate system. In fact, there's been a move, as you are aware of, to lowering direct tax rates. There's been a move, certainly in Europe, towards more reliance on indirect tax rates, but I'm not going to talk about any of that tonight. What I want to focus on first is the concerns people have on the welfare system as it works on those who are not in employment, and the issue of how best to get those types of individuals, or welfare recipients if you want, into the labour market. And that's what I want to look at. I think it's the most important issue in some sense in the design of welfare systems, and it's a kind of red hot policy issue to think about. I'm getting some feedback, but should live with that. Out-of-work benefits, then, the problem you're probably all aware of is that systems designed to relieve poverty, essentially, among particular target groups of families, in particular single parents in particular, there's the problem with that kind of benefit system is that, of course, if you start to earn money in that type of system, then there's an implicit tax rate at about 100% in most of these systems, sometimes a small earnings disregard. Effectively, you lose a dollar for dollar on the welfare benefit as your earnings rise. And in addition, there's loss of in-kind transfers like free dental care, free medical prescriptions, free housing, for example. Those kinds of things often are lost as you move into employment. And what I want to focus on then in the light of that concerns about that part of the welfare system is the issue of in-work benefits. It's a topic that's been of interest on both sides of the Atlantic, especially in the US and the UK, and coincidentally there's a big debate starting and going on in Canada right this minute, and I'll try and refer to Canadian reforms along these lines as I'm discussing this topic. The idea then is to make work pay, if you want, for individuals who are welfare recipients. And of course, thinking about how to design a welfare reforms that can do that while, of course, reducing the income too much of individuals who either can't find work or are not able to work is the difficulty in designing the reform. So, before I go into the types of reforms and thinking about those, what I want to do is put these reforms within the economic environment. Quite important things, of course, have been changing in the economic environment, especially in the labour market. And it's only within those kinds of characteristics of the economic environment can you begin to understand how this kind of welfare reform is going to operate. Well, one characteristic we know is the shift in demographic patterns. We know there are more retired, we know there are more single parents, and the single parents are going to be an interesting issue here to look at. In addition, there's a remarkable shifts in returns to education, in particular declining real wages for individuals who are less educated or less skilled. There's some remarkable facts about wages for the less skilled. For example, in the US, even the median real earnings have fallen year on year since the late 70s, and the lower deciles has fallen year on year since the mid 70s, since around 74 or 75. That characteristic is quite exaggerated in the US, but it's common to most developed countries that there's been a widening in the earnings distribution, and those with low skilled, exactly the type of people you find in the welfare system, welfare recipients, have found a falling return to being in employment continuously, certainly over this period of the last 15 years. In addition to that, of course, there's been an increase in income uncertainty, lots more chances for people to have repeat low-income spells. And on top of this, there are certain factors that bear on the costs of living for these individuals. In particular, one thing I'll focus on a little bit with regard to the UK, but I'm sure it's true, potentially true anyway, in Vancouver and lots of North American cities, is the increasing housing costs, especially among low-income households. And of course, typically in welfare programs, some housing assistance is given. And so you can find individuals in cities such as London with quite high welfare benefits covering mostly their housing costs, or to a large extent their housing costs. And of course, with a lowering return to education or a lowering of the real returns for individuals who are less skilled, exactly the group in the group on welfare, you have this dual problem of a lowering return in employment and an increasing level of benefit through things like housing costs and housing assistance. And I want to kind of bring all that together somehow and think about how we might design reforms that can kind of get round those problems and try and get some return for these individuals being in the labour market. So I'm going to focus on what are called in-work benefits. So these are designed to counter, as I said, the low wages and high implicit tax rate faced by those on welfare. The idea is to somehow modify the incentive structure so that a larger fraction of welfare recipients take jobs and leave welfare. And we want to do that in a way that doesn't, of course, create too much in the sense of lowering incomes of those who don't find it possible to find jobs. So here's the focus on in-work benefits. Well, there are a few that I want to look at. I've said that I'm going to look at the US, the UK, and Canada. It was a stroke of luck, really, that in Canada there's a self-sufficiency project, which is a randomised experiment into the effectiveness of in-work benefits. And one of the groups in this experiment is in BC, in Lower Mainland BC. And I'm going to use the evidence, or some of the evidence that's come out of that randomised trial, to try and figure out how these systems work, how effective they really are. In the US, there's been a long-standing system of this kind, but it's only in the last few years that it's really become an effective in-work benefit. And in the UK, over the last 10 years, we've had something called family credit. I'll explain all of these as I'm going along. And you'll see they all share very similar characteristics, all exactly the same aim. They're of course, designed with slightly different labour markets in mind and slightly different target groups in mind. But nonetheless, they're very similar, and they've become the important aspect of welfare reform. Earned income tax credit in the US is now the most, it uses up the most part of the US budget on welfare going to low-income households. So the idea then of these programs is they're designed to stimulate work from families in the welfare or poverty trap. That's the part of the welfare system that makes it essentially difficult for individuals to take work, in the sense that there's really no return and there could be losses through in-kind benefits from taking employment. Of course, still individuals do take employment. There are good reasons for doing that. The stigma of being on welfare, for example, is enough for some people to do that. How do they work, these systems? Well, from an economics point of view, I won't use much in the way of econometrics, I can assure you, and not much technical detail either. But nonetheless, a kind of simple way of thinking about a welfare system is to take an individual. In fact, of course, it's going to differ for every individual depending on their circumstances and what have you. That's why you look at many, many individuals when you're doing this kind of analysis. But you think of an individual and you think of all the income opportunities they would have in and out of work, and that gives you a good description of how the benefit system, if it works for them. Let me take the example of earned income tax credit in the US. This is the one that's been around for longest. It's been substantially reformed, and we might be able to learn something from the US into how effective these are going to be. Well, the way these kind of diagrams work is very simple. What you've got is you're looking at annual income, and you're seeing what net income the individual gets as they change their annual income through earned income, okay? And what we see here is annual income. And if you take together all the different welfare benefits that an individual can get in the USA, you'll find that the red line, that's what we call the budget constraint, effectively the amount of net income they get for an extra dollar of annual income, that's pretty flat. In fact, if it was an implicit 100% tax rate, it would be completely flat. And you can see in that little note, I hope you can read most of this, I tried to make it as clear as possible, it says we're abstracting from the aid for families with dependent children, the AFDC program, and food stamps. If we included those, then the red line would effectively be horizontal. For an individual who can effectively get a rather low wage in the economy, say something a little above the minimum wage, for most of the earnings they get would be lost dollar for dollar against those benefits as they go into earning income. The idea of the earned income tax credit is to give you the yellow line. The idea there is to give you a supplement to your income when you earn it. About a 40% supplement, in fact, is the way the current system works, so that if you earn a certain amount of income, you'll get 40% back as a tax credit. And that, of course, gives you more income in work. The only criteria is that you have to be a family, so you have to, it's typically these systems are designed for poor families in the welfare system. There's good reason for doing that, and I'll discuss that in a bit. And the individuals must be in work. So you can, of course, only get this tax credit if on your earned income. So it's an earned income tax credit. There's a 40% phase-in, and that gives quite a big credit to an individual. So an individual, this particular individual who's earning, I think, about $5 an hour, the tax credit they would get if they were to work up to that limit would be around $3,500 per year, which is a big supplement to their income, and it kind of gives them encouragement, if you want, to take jobs, even if the wage rate they can get is relatively low. Of course, there are issues with this. You're going to find individuals taking jobs with relatively low wages, and I'll discuss these as I'm going along, because it's all, of course, tied up with the issue of policies like minimum wages. And things of that kind. What happens, though, of course, if you give some money out as a tax credit, you can't keep this going on at all levels of earnings. Eventually, you have to kind of claw this back. And, of course, the big problem with designing these systems is if you give a supplement, say, at the 40% mark up to a particular lower level of earnings, then eventually you have to kind of claw it back so that individuals on very high earnings don't get a supplement. You're just trying to target the low earnings group. So in the earned income tax credit, the yellow line is what we call the new budget constraint, the post-reform budget constraint. That is, individuals get a supplement to their income. After a while, it's just kept constant. Once they've got the maximum they can get on this first part of the supplement, it's kept constant. And then it's phased out at what we call the phase-out rate. That's 21% at the current time for the earned income tax credit, until, of course, you're back to your old earnings schedule. So effectively, it just gives you more. It's effectively an earnings supplement for low earnings group. And, of course, it has to be clawed back eventually. And that clawback at the end causes some implicit tax rate. If you put it together with the tax system in the US, you find an implicit tax rate of around 53%. And so I've got a little arrow there saying that individuals who are out there, individuals who are already working, but now are working on fairly low earnings and could be eligible to claim earned income tax credit, will of course find their earnings rising and an implicit tax rate rising at that point, and they may choose to reduce their work effort, their hours of work. After all, they can reduce their hours of work per year, or they can reduce their work effort over the year and still retain the same level of overall income through the earned income tax credit. And so the issue really is to figure out what actually happens when you bring in a reform of this type. If there's lots of people up in that top line, what we call the windfall group, they're the group that just get a windfall. They were working anyway, and now we give a supplement to their earnings. Relative to the group that are not working and might find it now more attractive to take a job, even if it's at a relatively low wage. And the group, of course, that's of other interest, a group working already on relatively low earnings, and they face this steeper budget constraint now. For every dollar they earn, they get a little bit back as a supplement in addition. And one interesting question is, would we see those individuals working more or less if they have the choice? And that's something that we can really only examine from a little bit of economic theory plus some empirical, just looking at the empirical facts, which is what I will do. Well, another program that I thought would be fun to look at, which is very similar, is the self-sufficiency project in Canada. In fact, what I'm going to show you is some experimental evidence that wasn't done by myself, was done by a Princeton economist, David Card, on this program, evaluating this program. If you look at, this is an exaggerated budget constraint for a Canadian welfare recipient, but it kind of tells the story. If you've got an individual, a welfare recipient, say a single parent in Canada, say in BC, if they're on income assistance, they'll be eligible for income assistance. Effectively, what this gives is the budget constraint that an individual would face if they're earning the minimum wage in BC, which, at least when I last looked at it, was $6 an hour. If they're earning $6 an hour, then if they take some earned income, they increase their weekly hours of work, so they take a job at a few hours a week, they'll get some earnings disregard up to a small nominal sum of $200. Then effectively they lose all their earned income in a dollar for dollar transfer back to the income assistance program. So until they've exhausted their income assistance, that's right out nearly working nearly 50 hours a week, they would get no return, an implicit tax rate of 100% on their earnings. And clearly there's not going to be many individuals who choose to be in employment if that's the kind of schedule they face. Of course, there are other things going on in BC. There are many other programs. There's an enhanced earnings disregard system that raises this line a bit. So it's an exaggeration, but it kind of tells the story. And most of the welfare recipients that are in this particular randomized trial seem to face something rather like this. I'll give some evidence as we're going along. Well, what this program does, the self-sufficiency project, it says that if you're working 30 hours, if you find a job for 30 hours a week, that's averaging 30 hours a week over a period of a month. Okay, this is done on a monthly rolling period. Then what it will do is will give you the red line. It gives you a supplement to your income that suddenly makes it relatively attractive to work in those jobs. It's a neat little program in some ways because it's targeted on individuals who are going to take full-time work. You have to have been a welfare recipient for 12 months out of the last 13 months to be eligible. So it's really looking at the individuals, targeting those individuals. Typically single parents are going to fall into this group. And giving a supplement. Of course, it doesn't change their income assistance levels. So it's not, for example, causing more individuals who don't find employment to be on lower incomes. It's given a supplement to those who move into work. And the question is, really, who does it have any effect? It's a kind of interesting issue. This is a difficult group. These are typically fairly low-skilled, low-educated individuals. They're often single parents. You'd think that maybe their opportunities to move into work are relatively low. And so one interesting thing is just to see what happens. And the nice thing about this experiment, as we'll see, is that you can get some idea of how these things work by looking at this randomized trial. In fact, in the trial, all the individuals chosen are single parents, so we can that's what I'm going to focus on, that group. And they have to, as I say, move in from welfare into a full-time job. And the other interesting thing about this reform is it's an individualized benefit. So it doesn't depend on other earnings coming into the household, which could be, or other incomes effectively coming into the household, which for families with two adults working or one child working, one adult working is a very important aspect of the way the welfare programs work on labour supply. Of course, there's the windfall gain group as well in this. It's always exactly the same thing happens. You invent a system to try and draw individuals into work, but there's always a chance that there's people out there already working who'll find their income is enhanced. The idea of this reform is to enhance your income by 50% of the difference between a target income, which was set in BC to be $37,000 a year, way above the income assistance level. 50% of that difference of that number with your earned income. So you get a supplement of the 50% of the difference of those two, which can be an incredibly large increase in income for a low-wage individual who takes a full-time job. So it can be quite attractive. Individuals, of course, who are already working may decide to lower their work effort, and there's always that trade-off, because now they can, for the same earned income, they can get more actual net income by applying for this supplement. So that's an interesting case. Individuals who would have worked right out there may reduce their work effort. Of course, individuals who might have taken a part-time job may also decide to move into full-time work. And those arrows kind of describe the problems where we need to know exactly what the size of those arrows, those effects are, and that's what I'm going to try and look at. There's similar features to EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit. It's a very similar program, really. In some ways, it's more attractive. Of course, it's much more generous, and I'll be looking at the importance of relative generosity of these programs when I look at the actual statistics of what we get out when they're implemented. The last thing I want to look at, just to show you how it's happening everywhere, this kind of program, is family credit in the UK. This was designed for poor families. In fact, it's now been extended for poor families with single parents or two adult, two parent families. And now it's just been extended to single individuals without children. And this must be a reflection of the fact that we know that in the UK, exactly the same story. Those on the relatively low-skilled, low-educated group have had a fall in their real earnings year on year over time, effectively. And with an increase in housing assistance, it's just made it very unlikely that an individual on that level finds it attractive to be in employment. The idea of this is an interesting one. It's designed to give a supplement, a very large supplement, to individuals who satisfy the criteria. That is, they have their family members, and they work 16 hours a week. So, kind of part-time work. The idea here was that single parents might find it possible to take part-time work. Of course, if they're disadvantaged or low-educated, low-skilled, they're going to find they attract only very low wages. And the idea here is to give quite a large supplement to part-time work. Of course, so the issue is there much of an incentive created to move into work? How big is the effect of that? At the same time, you've got variation, at least in the UK one, with the number of children. So the height of this depends on kind of family size, family needs come into this. And if you can see the little red thing there, the 70%, that's quite interesting because that's the benefit withdrawal rate, that's the phase-out rate. And it's quite interesting that in the EITC program, that was quite low, around 20%. In the Canadian system, it's about 50%, and in the UK system, it's about 70%. That means that it's almost inevitable that individuals working up above this limit are going to find it relatively attractive to move down into more part-time work. And so you're going to have a trade-off between individuals moving in and others moving down onto part-time work. Of course, exactly what percent you put there is an interesting and difficult question, because if you make it too high, then you get this severe implicit tax rate. But if you make it too low, it goes out too far, and you find individuals on quite high incomes able to attract some supplement from this credit system. So the exact slope of that line is critical, and it really all depends how many people are out there and likely to be affected. One interesting recent reform, just to put it in context, was to in fact move this limit from 24 hours down to 16. So in the UK, there's been a deliberate effect to try and encourage individuals to move into part-time work. That's considered a good thing to do, effectively to kind of get them into the labour market. And I'll be looking at that reform. So overall, welfare to work benefits, how well do they work? Well, they're designed, as we've seen, to stimulate work from individuals and families in the welfare trap, typically poor families with children. Well, how are they going to work? It depends on a lot of things. It depends first on the way we think the labour market works, and that's a controversial issue. We all have different views of this. Some people think there's incredibly strong disincentives and that the reason you see individuals not working is purely through the benefit system. Others think there are other things going on in the labour market that mean those individuals are not in work. And really, it's almost an empirical issue. Especially for single parents, that's the group I'll be looking at. Are they likely to respond to earning supplements of the type that I've just been describing? And will those in work who now get the supplement, who would have been in work anyway or who are already in work but now eligible for the supplement, will they choose to counterbalance in a way the effect of individuals moving in by just reducing their work effort? Because, of course, they get a credit anyway, and they can do just as well effectively by working less hours over the year. And most importantly, properly, is there a longer run payoff to labour market attachment? Why are we doing it anyway? I mean, do we think there's something bad about people being long-term out of the labour market? Most people probably think there is. And if there is, then there must be some longer run payoff to labour market attachment. Eventually, people, through the progression of wages and getting attached to the labour market, get themselves out of low-income group and into a reasonable earnings level, which means, of course, they'd be less likely to be drawing income assistance or any of these tax credits. So we need to know what labour supply elasticities look like. That is, how elastic is the response of people's work effort to changes in the economic environment. And for different types of people too, lone parents are going to look a lot different from single young women or single young men without children, and look a lot different to labour supply of individuals in married couples after the children have left home. All these responses are likely to look very different. Perhaps more importantly, before I get onto that, we need to account for the interactions between all the forms of welfare and tax system, something that people typically don't do. They look at a programme in isolation and then find that, of course, it didn't have the outcomes they expected because it interacts with other benefits and taxes in quite a complicated way. I'll give you an example of that. This is from the British system. And now here's a budget constraint for a particular individual. You'll get used to seeing these. Very simple. What we have is their hours worked per week. And this individual, if they work no hours at all, then they will get some income support up to about just over £100 per week. Okay, that's the income support level for this particular individual, this particular family. And as they move along their hours of work, of course, what happens is, as they earn more pounds, they lose them in the sense that benefits are withdrawn. And you can see that happening. That's their budget constraint. So as they move from 0 to 14 hours of work, they effectively change, they have no change whatsoever in their earned income. This is a kind of characteristic we just saw in the Canadian Income Assistance Program, and it's more or less what you see in the Aid for Families with Dependent Children program in the US and the Food Stamps program. They all have pretty much the same effect. Now look at what the in-work credit does. This is the family credit that I just described for the UK. At 16 hours, you get a supplement to your income. And you can see already that it makes it relatively attractive for this individual if they weren't working. It may make it attractive for them to look and perhaps take a job at the 16-hour, the part-time place. But, of course, it's also attractive, potentially, for individuals working quite long hours, full-time hours, possibly to move back into part-time work. That might be attractive for a single parent who is paying childcare costs and prefers to stay with their children. If we, though, look at what happens if we add housing benefit is a very important benefit in the UK, and it's got similar effects in the US through housing assistance. Individuals who are in housing, who are in private rented housing, or in fact in the public sector rented housing, housing now, can claim their rent back more or less pound for pound against the benefit system. And you can see here, when you introduce housing benefit, this is for someone actually living in London where rents are relatively high, it more or less wipes out the whole family credit system completely. In fact, this individual, if they're determining how much to work according to this kind of budget constraint framework, then there really is going to be very little likelihood that they choose, at least on economic grounds, to take a job at all, because you can see the payoff is relatively slight. As they move from zero to 34 hours a week, they gain just a few pounds, relatively little. And if there's any cost of employment, then cost to work for them, they wouldn't take it. Interestingly, just like the Canadian system, what's happened in Britain now is to give an additional supplement, a kind of very ad hoc thing in a way, but very like the SPP, the self-sufficiency program, to give a supplement for full-time work, 30 hours a week. And I'll look at that reform if I get time at the end, because it's one I've looked at and it's an interesting one to consider. So you might think about introducing a full-time incentive. That's one. But the main point there is just to think that when you're thinking about how these reforms affect individuals, of course you wouldn't expect family credit to have any effect here at all, because you can see the family credit line, you know, it was there, the little yellow jump up in earnings at 16 hours. But when we introduce family housing benefit, it disappears. So if you're looking at individuals, different individuals, this individual versus some other individual, or this individual at a different point in time when they weren't eligible for this particular family credit benefit, there's going to be very little effect, because the credit is more or less wiped out by the workings of the rest of the rest of the system. And that can happen in the US as well through the earned income tax credit. I should add, in the Canadian program, it's slightly nicer, better designed than this. The supplement is effectively there, although it differs for individuals. It's more effectively there across all, as far as I can see, across all the different income assistance and other programs available in the Canadian system. So what are the policy issues on this and reforms? It's a really difficult area in a way, because each time you think of something, of course, it throws up some other difficulty, as we perhaps you're beginning to see in looking at these budget sets, as I've called them. The first policy issue is reducing phase-out tapers. This is the little thing you get. Effectively, that's what causes the poverty trap in the first place. You're on some benefit like income assistance, and as you make earnings, of course, you're losing your benefit pound for pound. And so you might want to phase it out slightly lower rate, not at 100%, but perhaps at a lower rate. And you saw already, it's kind of interesting, that in the UK we have a high benefit reduction rate, 70% on our income credit. The US has the lowest one, around 20%. And Canada's proposal, or this experiment anyway, of the self-sufficiency project is to have it around 50%. So the exact design of the phase-out taper, as I call it, or the phase-out rate, is critical in trying to figure out how to think about these in work benefits. And of course, there's always this problem: if I make it too low, then it's going to go too far up the distribution, and there's going to be lots of individuals who you really don't feel that a credit is a reasonable thing. They're already earning quite a reasonable amount of income. A credit is unnecessary. They're very unlikely to have any impact on them taking a job, for example, or working more. And and those individuals, nevertheless, are able to claim some of that credit. That's a kind of windfall group, and of course, it's a loss to the system, effectively. This issues to do with childcare earnings disregards. Obviously, you want to kind of target groups, and the groups that are most important, perhaps, to target are the individuals with young children. And of course, there's a whole issue of childcare earnings disregards, which I'll talk about maybe, if I get time, with regard to the British reforms. One interesting issue, though, if you put the whole structure within the economic environment, is to think what was going on here. What we've seen is that part of the problem is just that the returns to work for individuals who are less educated at the bottom of the pile, as it were, have been falling continuously over time. And there are a number of solutions you can think of. Of course, one simple solution that looks simple and looks attractive, at least to begin with, is a minimum wage solution. Just up the wage. Don't let it go that low. But of course, we all know that there's problems with that, and we can discuss them as we're going along here. The alternative, of course, is to try and get the return of those individuals up a bit through training programs or longer time spent in education. And of course, all these things have to be taken together. If you can do that effectively, then there's no need for most of these programs, as the return individuals will get in work would be sufficiently high. Another issue is on the job experience effects and the payoff to employment. Something, it's surprising that labour economists know relatively little about this. Still a controversial issue. It's an issue of whether individuals once in work, at least low-skill, low-educated individuals, really get much of a payoff to staying in work, okay, in terms of enhancing their wages over time. And that's an interesting issue. And if it's relatively low, then of course it means that these systems that try and get people into the labour market, if they don't, of course, progress up the wage distribution, then of course they're going to be stuck on these credits, and it's almost like being stuck continuously in the welfare system. The high hours cut-off, we saw that kind of cut-off so that there's a full-time work. You only get the credit if you're in full-time work or something along those lines. So individuals are putting in a reasonable amount of effort to get the credit. And finally, individualisation of benefits. Most welfare benefits, unlike taxes, are on joint income. They're kind of needs-based. They're based on issues of poverty of the whole family, for good reason, of course. And so if any one individual earns money, then typically, of course, that will affect the benefits going to the whole family income. And, of course, that can have a high disincentive effect to work for obvious reasons. So the big issue, really, or at least the one interesting issue, is how would people respond to these kinds of welfare reforms? I mean, we can debate them, and of course we can have strong opinions. Some people would say no response at all. Others would say, of course, people will respond very strongly to these effects. But this is an empirical issue. And the things we want to look at then are the participation effects for those not in work. So we'd like to know, if we put these credits in place, is it likely that we're going to get people moving off the welfare rolls into work? Okay, but if we do put them in place, what are the hours responses for those in work, in particular in the phase-out region? Are they likely to kind of move back down so that, in fact, the two things counteract? It's possible that could happen. And if it does, then is there really any benefit to the system whatsoever? You've got some people moving in, but others working less who are already in. And so that's an important issue. What are the likely size of responses? Well, here's a little bit of trivial microeconometrics, I suppose, because there's an issue. Of course, you can look at data and you can think you've seen something, but typically you haven't. It kind of disappears in front of you, you might say. And this is a sad characteristic of empirical economics. But the simple cross-section correlation is probably the one that disappears quickest. It looks often as if there's some very strong correlation or association in the data, but typically it's not a good association to base policy on, in the sense that if you make some reform, it's unlikely that this is really picking up a causal effect, rather just an association in the data. The kind of thing you can do is just plot the relationship between for example, hours of work that in individuals, as we see individuals, we can look at a sample of individuals. They have different hours of work over the year or over the week and different wages. We could kind of plot that and see what it looks like. And you might get something like this. In fact, you often do. What we call a rather nice result. It's a nice upward sloping, what we call a labour supply curve. That is, if we increase the wage, it looks like people put in more effort. And if we knew that for sure, then, of course, this would at least suggest to us that if we can increase the wage for those in work, that for those who are not in work, then there's a very good chance that some of those will move into work and we'll get at least the right an increase in work effort for those individuals. The problem is, with these kinds of simple plots, is there's lots of reasons. Oh, one way you could think of this, and I won't spend a lot of time on things like elasticities, but we tend to talk about elasticities, and you might see something, I'll have a few of these, but not too many, like 0.81. That just means that a 10% increase in wages, that a 10% rise in the hourly wage rate, for example, which is the kind of thing you often see in these kinds of supplements, would induce an 8% increase in effort, in hours of work. Okay, and that's the kind of thing we'll need to guide what the effect of these reforms is likely to be. The problem is that these simple correlations, there's just loads of when you think about it, there's just loads of reasons why hours and wages, work effort and returns you get in work are correlated, but nothing to do with the causal from increasing wages to increasing labour supply. It's just that you find that kind of association. It might be, for example, that individuals, you find people working long hours that are, and also having high wages, but that's just for unobservable. That's just their particular reasons that have nothing to do with that they don't work longer hours just because they have higher wages. It's just an association we see in the data. And this has caused worries, because what's happened is people have moved away from simple plots, simple cross-sections, to things that are closer to experiments. And I'll look at those a little bit. In fact, the word natural experiment is used a lot in economics now. And you might think there's good reason for this, especially in this kind of area, because you see lots of reforms happening. You just look over the Thatcher years in the UK, and there is almost a reform every year. And you could think, well, you know, you often think of the Thatcher years being called the Thatcher experiment. Can't you use the changes in policies that were going on then as kind of experimental data? And that's certainly been done in the UK and the US to look at these things. But it's not so clear this is going to work that well, or at least you have to do it carefully. Let me give an example, a pretty simple one. You may just follow the discussion as I'm going along, but it's one that shows how misleading you can go with this kind of thing. This is a simple budget constraint for an individual. It's kind of an individual here. As they increase their hours, that's the net income they get. And there's one group of individuals who don't pay taxes. They're the low-income individuals. There's a tax allowance or some tax threshold. And below that, there's no taxes to be paid. So they get the green line. But if their hours of work of particular wage go over the allowance A, then they start paying taxes, okay? So most tax systems are progressive in that sense, in that you find one group of individuals paying relatively low direct tax rates, and then as you move up the earnings taxes, effective marginal tax rates will increase. And you might think of using that as an experiment, because, of course, if you think of a reform, imagine the kind of Reagan-style reforms or the Thatcher-type reforms that happened US and the UK. And what we found was that over time, individuals that were paying taxes had their marginal tax rate reduced. So effectively, they got more income for each hour they worked. And that would be like moving from the yellow line to the red line. So we have something we could call a before and after type experiment. We can see the individuals before the change and after the change. And there's lots of these changes happening. So we should be able to learn something from this. And what we could see is that this is rather like an experiment, because if you think of the people that weren't affected by the tax reform, they shouldn't change their behaviour at all. Okay, they're like a control group. If you think of experiments, you have controls and treatments. Okay, the controls are the people who are there to control for other things that are happening in the economy that happen to be happening at the same time as the reform happened, as the reform took place, but are unaffected by the reform, so they work as a good baseline to compare with the individuals that did face the tax change. Okay, and you could imagine that what we might do is look at, what happened to individuals who faced the tax rate, say, during the Thatcher reforms or during the Reagan reforms, Their tax rates went down, so their wages went up. We could see, well, is there a big difference in a big increase in the relative wages over that period of people who paid taxes to people who didn't pay taxes, and use that as some kind of experimental control. And if you look at the differences, this is for the UK, it's pretty astonishing. This is the difference between the wage rate of people in the tax system, that's paying basic taxes, and those who are not on the benefit system, they're not on anything like that, they're just individuals who have earnings that are low enough to not be paying taxes. And that's quite a lot of individuals in the UK, especially in, for example, secondary workers in households. And what you see is that the tax reforms appear to have had a big effect. Wages, there's an increase. So the wages of those taxpayers have increased relative to the non-taxpayers. And, of course, what we'd hope to see is that their work effort would have also increased. But if you look at hours differences, you get exactly the opposite. In fact, the hours of people paying taxes have fallen relatively over this period to those not paying taxes. And, of course, given that those individuals have faced lower tax rates, it's not surprising. When you put the picture together and you try and work out the elasticity, you get the incredibly puzzling result that you increase wages and hours of work or labour supply goes down. Not a very good result for economists, not such a strong result anyway, because almost all tax reforms, of course, especially the Thatcher and Reagan tax reforms, would fall apart completely if this was what was going on. But it's unlikely to be such that that's going on. In fact, really, why these experiments fall apart is that if you think about them, they're not really like experiments that we conduct in a laboratory. The problem is that there's lots of changes going along, and we're not really having the same groups. We're not really comparing like with like. In fact, what we call it is there's composition changes over time. And a good example of this is that after the reform, lots of individuals that move into work, in fact, quite a few individuals join the labour market over this period. And they join the labour market working full-time, but at relatively low hours of full-time. And so you get a different group in the treatment group. You're not even keeping the same group constant over time. And what you find is that the hours of work in the treatment group is really it's a different group over time. And it's easy to see that that would be falling just for composition reasons. And what we've done is fix this up by using the changes in the returns to education as an experiment, saying that that is something that's exogenously hitting individuals, driven by changes in trade patterns, changes in technical change. And those things are kind of outside the control of the individuals. If you use those as relatively exogenous changes in things, external to the individual's choices, and, of course, free from composition changes, then you get an elasticity that's relatively small. And the reason I point this out is that the first elasticity is very like what was used to evaluate the reforms that were suggested by Thatcher and Reagan. And effectively, those elasticities just look a little bit too high. We just didn't expect, and we didn't find, responses of that magnitude. We wouldn't expect them to be negative. But actually, elasticities that are relatively modest seem to be what's going on in the economy, at least for certain groups, typically the groups that we see in the welfare system, for example. And there's supporting evidence of this from the US and Canadian studies as well. Well, that was a bit kind of technical ride through this, but I thought it was worth doing because the idea of using policy reforms as natural experiments is very popular and kind of sounds very convincing, but you have to be careful. Just think about that it's not an exact experimental design. And, of course, if compositions change over time in the treatment and control groups, then, of course, you lose the notion that that's a correct experiment. Okay, what I want to look at now, just in the last few minutes, yes, I'm running out of time, is just on the evidence. Looking at the EITC reforms, those in the US, you find it's it's interesting. If you put together what I've just been described on trying to get reasonable elasticities, reasonable responses, what you find is that if you look at this particular reform, phase-in rate raised 11 to 14%, and phase-out rate reduced from 12 to 10%. These were the first reforms in the mid-80s. Along these lines, effectively what you're doing is inducing a bigger rise in the tax credit, so it's more likely to induce individuals into work, but reducing the taper off, so there's less. It's going further out up the budget constraint. What we find is that among low-educated groups, there's a 6.1 percentage point increase in their participation. That's quite a big effect, in fact. And these programs do seem to work pretty well on these types of low-educated groups, especially exactly the groups who are typically welfare participants. Those welfare recipients, the high school, the beyond high school group, relatively little effect, but you wouldn't expect that. Among ours effects, well, of course, this is the windfall. This is the kind of cost of the program. You put in a program, it may, of course, cause individuals who are already working or would have worked to reduce their work effort. That doesn't seem to be the case. There's some reduction, but it's not enough to offset the increase in participation. And this is a pretty positive result for these kinds of programs. I thought what I'd just finish with is the programme that's closest to all of your hearts. That's the self-sufficiency project in Canada. The reason it's a nice one to finish on, it's a randomised trial, and that's a useful thing to be looking at because it's the closest thing to an experimental design. In fact, what happened was there were 6,000 families followed for 5 years. In fact, we're only in the middle of that now. It was the beginning of 1993 that this all started. So I can only report results that I found for the first part of that study. But the idea is that one half of the group of 6,000 were offered the program and the other were not. They're the controls, and the ones that were on the program are the treatments. And we can compare those two groups. And of course, the eligibility to this, as I said before, is you have to find a full-time job within 12 months. That's the treatment group. The rest are the controls. The controls and the treatments look very similar before the experiment takes place. That's a good design. That means that they're going to effectively, the controls are really quite a good match for the treatment group. And what we're looking for then is this self-sufficiency program increasing earnings for those who take the 30-hour jobs and move off welfare into work. And here's some results. Well, this is at the beginning of the program, and we're looking at months from when the program started. The yellow line is what the control group did. They're the people who are on income assistance. They're just going along as ever. And the red line is what they're the group that get this credit, this effective tax credit, this self-sufficiency credit. The impact on earnings is quite dramatic. There's almost a doubling in earnings for the treatment group. That's a very important result. The impact on hours, very similar. These are low hours working individuals. The criteria is they work at least 1 week of the month they're looking at 30 hours. That's the rule. And you can see the treatment group has increased its hours of work more or less twofold over the control group. So it's having quite a big effect on the hours of work chosen by these individuals. And similarly, if we look at the impact on employment, 16 months into the project, which is all that I could get evidence for, there's quite a long-lasting effect, at least so far, of this project on employment. The treatment group are just doing much better in terms of employment than the control group. These are all single parents, and it's quite, in a way, a surprise that there's such an effect for those individuals. And the big questions are, do these participants retain attachment to full-time work, and do they fall back into the income assistance program? Well, there seems to be a big impact, especially for families with two or more dependent children. And what turns out to be the case is especially so in the BC project, so that was something to take account of. After 14 months, then, we see the fraction of those on this program are working full-time is twice as much as among the controls. This fits in neatly with the results using those more reasonable elasticities that I gave for the US. That is, there's a reasonable impact on participation from these programs. The problem, though, is that recipients typically take low wages, and this is where we need more information on world wage progression. Given the way time is, I'm going to skip over the British reforms that, and if people are interested now, I can go over them, but I've written on this anyway, and I can give you the stuff. Let me go through those quickly. The one drawback of this technology is that, of course, I have to show you what I'm going to miss out. I can't slip over the slides, but there you are. But at least it hasn't collapsed on me. And an incredible thing about this, as I was telling people before, is that, of course, it's projected from behind the screen. So when I tried it out yesterday, everything was in reverse and I nearly died. But and finding the appropriate button to press to get it to come the right way was a nerve-wracking experience. But anyway, just to kind of summarise what I've been able to get through, but I think it's obviously a very important area. Looking at conclusions, the first thing is to worry about the methods you're using to evaluate likely responses. It's a very empirical topic, this. Exactly how people react is the critical thing, because if you have very big elasticities, it will give you very different effects to low elasticities. So this gives a good role for empirical economists. But of course, we don't want to mistake correlation for causation. You know, with just an association in the data is not enough, of course, to judge, to derive policy from. And I gave you one example of where you can see that going wrong. The other point, I think, is to capture the interactions with the rest of the welfare system. If you just put these systems straight on a picture, ignoring the rest of the tax system and the benefit system, they can look very attractive. When you put them on particular individuals who are involved already in food stamps, income assistance, housing assistance, whatever the program is that they're available, is available to them, you can find, of course, very different impacts, and that has to be taken together. Of course, the experiment I was alluding to takes full account of all that, because it allows individuals to have full access to all the benefits available to them. And the idea then was to counter the falling real wages for the less skilled, and the welfare recipients are clearly going to be in this group. They're the most disadvantaged group. They have relatively low experience in the labour market. They wouldn't have had any experience effects on their wages. They're typically low education. So as the real wages fall for this group, and this seems to be something that's probably going to be a continuing pattern as kind of trade and technology changes that way, then it's going to be, for a given level of benefits, it's going to become less and less attractive for those individuals to be in employment. And the idea is, with that in mind, how do we kind of redesign the welfare system to stimulate those individuals back into work? Well, a careful design of the phase-out benefit reduction rate and the level of the benefit seems to be one possible way of doing this. And the self-sufficiency program seems to be quite a nice kind of compromise. You have a 50% implicit tax rate as the benefit is withdrawn. It avoids a large windfall group, but doesn't have such a high implicit tax rate as we find in the UK system, where effectively the credit is withdrawn at a very high rate. Is there a lasting effect of the reform? Well, labour market attachment, and that's why I really wanted to look at this Canadian experiment, because it's really the first experiment I've seen where individuals are following some time after the reform. In fact, because they're still in the system, it's not a complete story. We need the whole five-year trial before we can really tell. But it looks like there's a continuing labour market attachment that's significantly enhanced, and very little drop back into welfare for these individuals, which, if it's true, is going to be a very positive thing to find. The bad side, though, is that these individuals typically take very low wages, and typically not much above the minimum wage. And if hourly wages, if they don't increase over time, then these individuals are in very kind of poorly paid, low-skilled jobs. And, of course, we need more evidence on that. But the issue of training and minimum wages come to play here. If there were no minimum wages, then maybe earnings for these individuals would be driven even lower. And effectively, of course, I mean, the wage they claim. And effectively, there can be a deal between the employer and the employee to exploit the system. So here's one case where a minimum wage can be quite an effective mechanism of making sure that doesn't happen. So that's the end, and that's all I've got to say. Yes, do you want the lights?
Yes, there we are. We'll have our usual question period today. Yes, Robert first.
You said at the outset of your remarks that what we see widely in Europe, the United States, and elsewhere, is increasing reliance on higher rates of indirect taxes. As we look at the situation trying to achieve reform in Canada of indirect taxes, do you have any particular suggestions, bearing in mind that both the federal government and the provincial governments are in this field and are rivals for revenue?
Repeat the question.
Any particular reforms that would occur to you arising out of what you showed us tonight?
Okay. The question was on whether there was, on the reform of indirect taxation, that's on VAT and sales tax, those kinds of sides of things, and in particular how it might relate to what I've discussed this evening. Of course, it's a much more general issue than I've discussed. The first thing I should note is that it's a well-known fallacy that indirect taxes have a different impact to direct taxes on the labour on incentives to work. In fact, there was a famous Economist article recently that suggested that indirect taxes effectively have a free lunch. That they, of course, reduce direct taxes, therefore making work more attractive, and yet they raise revenue. And of course, if we think that the effective tax rate is really the wage rate in terms of consumer goods, if you want. And so it's really the real wage when we talk about it is the wage to prices. And if all you're doing is switching between direct tax rates and indirect tax rates, that can have a relatively neutral effect on work effort for any particular individual. Of course, it has different distributional effects. That's the first thing on introduction between the old and the young, and they are all pretty obvious. Indirect tax rates are paid by everybody, but direct tax rates are just paid by those, effectively those in work. So over the life cycle, then there's not much of a difference in the overall welfare, but of course there's a distributional consequence of introduction. I mean, it's difficult, of course, to design an indirect tax rate, an indirect tax system that has the kind of progression that you might like in a direct tax system. And that must be one of the most critical issues here to think of. If you worry about the way it's been carried out in Europe is to have certain goods that are consumed by the poor, more by the poor, for example, food in the UK is exempt from taxation and thereby getting some progression. But if you go for a uniform indirect tax rate, then of course that's that doesn't have any particular relief for low-earned income individuals. I guess the kinds of issues that are often raised in its favour are the ease of collection, the problems, less problems with evasion, and those kinds of issues. But I think in terms of the labour market, I think there's relatively little effect, and that's probably too extreme. But lots of people think there is a big gain to moving to indirect taxes in terms of work effort, but I don't see that at all. Don't know whether that's been fully answered the question.
The question back there? What's the question?
He's talking about within some sort of closed system that works in Hog Cuckoo Land. But I don't know where in real life it is.
Good. So you're talking about the what we call the black economy or the shadow economy. So
I call it the economy.
The economy, okay.
Can you tell me what the question was?
I think... The question was that, of course, there's another way of earning income, and that is to earn income and not declare it, and to earn it in the illegal sector or in the shadow economy, or to take to crime. And there's no question that there's both of those things are worrying aspects, especially among low-educated welfare recipients. That's important. Firstly, on the shadow economy, it's trying to gauge how important that really is. We all think it's important because everybody gets their building done through the shadow economy. But if you actually look at the total expenditure that any individual makes on things that are produced in the shadow economy, it's a very small amount. If you put together all the things that are not traded in the shadow economy, food, all the things that we buy, food, clothing, all that, it's quite clear that it's very easy to exaggerate the role of the shadow economy in total production, at least in economies like the UK, Canada, and that. So it's not that it's an unimportant issue, but it's certainly one that tends to get over-exaggerated. It's one that we should worry about, of course.
You've had your question.
War is a shadow economy?
Ah, war, I do.
We'll have a question back there now.
Yes, I'd like to just add something that may help with what this gentleman is saying. I'm on the technical advisory committee for the self-sufficiency project, and as Richard has said, there are some effects of that program which are quite spectacular compared to the rest of the world. One thing which has made it that way, one design feature, which is very important with respect to what the gentleman said, is that the money is paid out as a wage supplement. And so a person gets the supplement, the top-off, only hour by hour for the extra hours that they work. And the reason that this was done in the first place was to try and counteract the various problems you get with a program like this, including people taking the supplement and then working in undeclared work. In this case, if they don't declare the hours of work, they may avoid tax on that extra money, but they do not get supplement payments for it. And also, in terms of other problems that you have, in terms of them not wanting to work because of the tax system beginning to kick in at some point, again, they're only getting the supplement for the hours that they actually declare under the program.
Does everybody hear that?
The statement. Something I should have mentioned, it's a very interesting experiment, this. To get the self-sufficiency program money, you have to send in your stubs, effectively your salary stubs that show how many hours that you've worked. That's exactly the same as the British Family Credit System, precisely the same, in fact.
And of course, there are ways that you can get around that in illegal ways, but it seems to work pretty well, and I would say the same thing for this program.
Yes, question over here.
Yes. You mentioned a number of times the one-parent families. As a matter of fact, all those programs seem to be directed at one-parent families. Now, it is an old criticism of welfare systems that they tend to break up families. Wouldn't these programs have the same effect? Or
did they could... Yeah, they could. We certainly worry about that. The question is, if you design a program that's targeted to one group, like single parents, then that gives an incentive for individuals who are not in single parent relationships to effectively form them. So either for singles to have children and become single parents, or for divorce or whatever you want. There's quite a lot of recent research on that. And it's using the same kind of ideas that I was suggesting before, looking across states in the US at differences in the level of these benefits. They're very different in their generosity. And although this is the first shot at this, there are lots going on, it seems to be relatively difficult to explain anything about family formation directly from the benefit system. Of course, there's a kind of correlation there, but when you look at really effective differences across states, it looks relatively different. There's lots more going on. You can, of course, there is an association there. But there's a Berkeley economist, Hilary Hoynes, who's done some work on this that looks quite careful and finds relatively little effect. It's effectively an empirical question. If you want to target a group, then, of course, the problem is that group isn't just there. In some sense, it can choose to be there. And that's an important point. I take the demographic changes as kind of given in what I've been describing, so you're right to criticise that. On the other hand, I doubt if it's a really big effect from what I've seen on the evidence.
Oh, question over here.
Right. That's we spend a lot of time doing exactly that kind of thing. So the issue is you want the net effect on the revenue of these programs. And, of course, the point is that as individuals move into work, they start paying taxes, they come off income assistance, and they come off other programs. So it's a complicated effect on total government revenue. And I haven't done any of that here, but everything that we would typically do would do all of that. When you say a ripple effect, I mean the first round effects with the reactions of individuals as I've tried to describe them are quite easy to do. You can just put that through your computer simulation. Of course, the ripple effect in the sense of that if it's not a neutral change, so there's a kind of expansion or contraction, the ripple effects on the whole economy are much harder to gauge. But the kind of first round with the reactions, as I've tried to describe them, of people moving in and out using these kinds of elasticities. That's what we would typically do, and that's important.
Question back there.
That's certainly been the suggestion of the question is if you've got these very high, in fact we just saw it effectively happening for these low earners, but you can of course get it at the top earners. If you reduce the effective tax rate, you might find an increase in work effort and an increase in that's sufficiently high to counteract the loss of revenue from the lower tax rate through increased earnings, and then an overall increase in total revenue coming into the government coffers. I mean, that was precisely one of the other arguments behind the Reagan and Thatcher tax reforms at the top. I guess, you know, if you start from 100%, it kind of has to be true, right? And so there must be somewhere going down from 100% and lower where it's it will eventually become not the case. Where that lies is very controversial. Most people, I don't know why this is the case, most people seem to think that 50% is where it lies. The evidence for that is pretty slight, though, I would say. But certainly, I guess, when it was kind of 95% in the UK and whatever, it's exactly the same kind of problems that I was hinting at here. They're just too high, and you can do better than that.
Question over here.
Were two questions or comments. The questions were relating to individuals who have children. I guess you're thinking about women workers in their kind of mid-career who start a family.
To pay the mortgage.
And you're worried about them dropping out of work at the time of and losing all that human capital and that they've grown up. I'm not sure that the evidence is so strong that individuals do take so much time out. I mean, the experience payoff is quite high for those types of individuals. Most of them will try to get back in employment as soon as possible. And of course, because the return to being in employment is quite high, and the loss to losing years of experience is quite high as well. So I think you see most women, for example, re-enter fairly quickly into the labour market. The question is why is that a bad? So one question, and it's related to your childcare question, is why is it the individual or the firm that should deal with this, or the government? Because you could imagine that the government could institute certain maternity leave arrangements, it could institute certain childcare arrangements, and firms and workers could do the same. I guess, what do I think about that? I guess the childcare thing is a difficult one to judge. So if it's all on the issue is if it's all on private return from the firm or the worker, why doesn't the firm or worker sort out the childcare arrangements? And in many cases, I guess they do. Yeah, I don't know. I'm
going to
hive that one. I'm getting tired.
We'll have two more questions. One here and then one there.
Sorry.
I was unclear about your comment on the size of the shadow economy.
Yeah.
Were you saying the shadow economy is relatively small in relationship to the total economy or in relationship to the amount of activity among the low and no income groups?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the question is, the shadow economy might be relatively small regard to total GMP, but it might be very important for welfare recipients. And that it obviously is more important in the income of individuals on income assistance. And one interesting thing about this program, especially, for example, the Canadian program, but by doing a randomized trial, you can learn things, I guess, that would be difficult to learn from either data collected by other means or kind of models of the of the type I was describing earlier. Of course, what you see, the individuals in the control group have got all the access to the shadow economy that they had before, and the individuals in the treatment group that get the program also have all that available to them. So one of the attractions of experiments is that you don't have to say too much about what's going on. You're just measuring outcomes. So the effects I was pointing to that look quite similar to what we might have thought had happened from the participation effects I was getting out of the credit system for the US. They look similar. And that's reassuring because, of course, it's suggesting with everything else going on, childcare arrangements, shadow economy, we're still seeing an effect.
Can I just make one addition? Yeah. Do you have a Heisenberg effect, though, where people change their behavior for being observed?
The question over here?
Yeah.
I'm trying to get...
A Hawthorne effect, sorry. Yeah.
That's worrying about how much we're changing their behavior by measuring.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get a reality check on this, and I know for economists,
that's Yeah, that's true.
But if I heard you correctly, if we give people the right incentives, and by not removing their benefits, they will find work. And we'll come back. So my first question is, where was that work before they looked for it?
Mm-hmm.
Good
question, yeah.
If it existed, wouldn't I argue along with Genghis Khan that since the jobs exist there, all these programs are disincentive for them to find any work at all? Let's just remove the programs. Now there's a wonderful
system. Yeah. The suggestion is to remove income assistance programs.
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
Remove
it. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
I can respond to this one. And we have an idea. Okay, underlying all of this is some idea about some level below which we don't want people to fall. Okay? And what I said at the beginning is the return that people are able to get in the labour market has been falling over time for these types of individuals. In other words, you know, you would find individuals with low levels of education, not much labour market attachment, just let's say low level education. Because of changes in the worldwide economy, effectively, only available to the return they would get is sufficiently low that if they worked full-time work, they would still get below what we would consider to be a reasonable level of income. So we're thinking of a supplement here. Okay. The increase in the minimum wage would, with the usual argument against increasing the minimum wage. Is that, of course, for the individuals that are still staying in employment, they would of course increase their income. But for the firms that have to pay the minimum wage, they would find most of these jobs not worth hiring individuals on anymore. So if you've got a low-skilled individual, the question is, would you still be willing to hire them at the minimum wage? I suspect that effect is overdone. I'm not saying that it's very, very important, but you can see some logic here. You take a low-skilled individual. Are they really going to be employed at $6 or $7 an hour, or do you need some kind of wage supplement to get that employment to happen? And that's really what's lying behind this, I think. But it's a very interesting point.
We could clearly go on for some time, but I'm going to in a moment ask Dr. Ishaq Kutwal to thank our speaker for tonight. Let me remind you, as we close the evening, of what the advantages of joining the Institute. The lectures are free, but the Institute is very powerful. Last week, we had a talk on the lies of the cigarette industry, and a few days later, one of the big five admitted that they were actually telling lies. So that the Institute tries to do its best. Let me also say that the Institute has no lecture next week between Good Friday and Easter. We will have one 2 weeks from now, but next week, nothing. So for those of you who have withdrawal symptoms, I suggest buying a book, maybe even one of Professor Blundell's books, or buy a book as you go out on how to prepare your income taxes or something like that, and read it next week. The following week, Saturday, we have Professor Peter Borwein, who's going to be telling us some marvelous things. He's a very enthusiastic person about how, well, computers don't think, but they now do many of the things that mathematicians do.
and help, not only as calculating tools, but really in doing mathematics that we couldn't do before. It's a very fascinating subject, and I urge you to come back 2 weeks from now on April 5th on Saturday to hear Professor Borwein. I'm now going to ask Professor Goodwill, who's head of the Economics Department at UBC, to thank our speaker for today.
Thank you, Richard. In the December issue of the New Yorker, there was an article called "The Decline of Economics" by John Cassidy. It made a lot of valid points about the field of economics, but in my opinion, the case was overstated. The main point of the article was that economists spend far too much time in doing very esoteric things, and they have precious little policy advice to offer. I do wish very much that John Cassidy was in the audience today. Now, I thank you, Richard, for explaining so clearly and in an interesting way an interesting topic which could be potentially tedious. Most of us have some views on tax reforms and work reforms, and we have, in fact, very strongly held convictions. But you have provided a framework to allow us to assess the trade-offs. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm very grateful, because I always knew that my long-held convictions about these issues were completely right, but you have today explained to me why. Now, we are very grateful we have scholars of the stature of Richard Blundell to come and teach us what they know, but this has only been made possible by the generosity of the Woodward family, who has created a Woodward Endowment, and Economics Department has been very fortunate in this respect. And I thank the Woodward family, and I thank you for coming. Thank you.